Well, even if you have room only to grow a couple of vegetables, I would bet that you, if you've only got a couple, one of them might be tomatoes. It's not because they're particularly easy to grow necessarily. Usually they need more water and food than a lot of other veggies. But it's so hard to get a really delicious and juicy tomato at the store. And even when a grocery store tomato looks good, it's frankly, it's often mealy and tasteless when you bite into it. And that's because taste has been sacrificed for produce that will travel well and keep longer on the shelf. Well, Harry Klee wants to change that. He is a professor of horticultural sciences in the plant molecular and cell biology program at the University of Florida, and he joins us from his office in Gainesville, and we're really glad to have him with us today. Harry, thanks for taking time to be with us here on the Ideas Network.
Oh, you're welcome.
A great pleasure to have you here. Taste. You know, I read somewhere that of all we learn, about 1.5% we learn through taste, but taste means a whole lot more when it comes to really good foods. We can learn a lot about it and really remember a good tasting tomato. What do we mean when we refer to taste as a human sense?
Well, taste is actually a much more complicated word. Really, what I always tell people is if you take tomato, for example, taste is really the integration of multiple senses in your brain. So when you're eating a tomato, it's really a spot in your brain that's lighting up that's saying, oh, I'm getting all of these cues, visual cues, textural cues when you chew. But the two main cues would be the taste receptors on your tongue and the volatile chemicals, the things that you smell that you're picking up in your nose. And your brain is integrating all of those signals, and a spot in your brain is lighting up that says, ooh, I'm eating a tomato.
And looking at tomatoes, or just looking at fruits and vegetables in general, what are the compounds that traditionally contribute to taste, to what we taste?
So for the most part, you know, and the taste system is actually very simple on your tongue. You've got sweet, sour, salty, and bitter, and one that we call umami. And really, so, you know, you've got your sugars, you've got your acids, and you've got salt that are having a huge impact on what you taste. But, you know, if you think about the last time you had a cold and you couldn't breathe, what did something taste like? You know, it didn't taste like much of anything.
No.
And I think that's where that's a really good test that shows you how important smell is to taste. That really it's the chemicals that we call volatiles, the things that go up into the air and you smell, that really give us what we would call flavor, really enrich beyond the sugars and the acids and the salts.
Why did you choose to focus your research on tomatoes? I'm glad you are, but I really, but. Maybe that's why, because a lot of people wanted it.
Well, I think there are actually a few practical reasons. Number one, it's a great system to work on as a geneticist, as a molecular biologist. It turns out that because I'm in Florida, it's a major crop in Florida, one of the biggest crops in terms of acreage in Florida. But it's also a really cool crop to work with in terms of being able to manipulate it. And honestly, people are passionate about tomatoes. It's really fun when you tell them that you work on a tomato and you're working on flavor. I mean, you can just talk for hours with somebody after you tell them that.
Alice in Two Harbors, Minnesota has a comment for you. Alice, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi, Larry. I'm a diehard Wisconsinite, but I now live in Two Harbors, but I do look at Wisconsin. We're right across the lake. And I'm originally from New Jersey, and my mother is 88. Mm-hmm. And she remembers, and I do too, that she is just dying for a good old Rutgers tomato sandwich. And she said she's never had one since, and she's 88. And I do know they've taken the vinegar quality out, but they must have done something else because it's also very hard to can them and come up with that crisp, just when you bite into it, you know, it just takes over your whole palate, and there's nothing like, when I was young, we had dear friends, and they had no money at the time, and we had a pile of kids, and they had a pile of kids, and Aunt Hazel and Uncle Lou said, bring them on up, we got tomatoes.
Well, Rutger, so tomato, and 88-year-old mom hasn't had a good tomato in 70 years.
That's about right. So Rutgers is actually known back in the World War II age for producing a couple of varieties. One of them is called Rutgers, and they're really good tomatoes. They're fabulous. We've grown them up ourselves, and they've been lost because they don't have the shelf life. The yields aren't really what the modern tomato varieties are. But there's no doubt that the flavor is not there today, whereas the old Rutgers varieties. Now, people from New Jersey will chauvinistically say, it's also the soil. And, you know, there may be this concept of terroir that you get with wine, but...
or cheese, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people will claim that there's something special about the area in New Jersey where those tomatoes were grown. But taken together, I think that your caller is absolutely correct. There's nothing that compares with the old varieties grown and picked when they're ripe. You know, the biggest problem, people always say, well, what's happened to the tomato? And I think to put it in perspective, you have to appreciate a couple of different things. Unless you're Alice Waters and have a whole lot of money, most people do not want to eat a product in season only. Most people, if in January in Madison you want a tomato, you expect to go to your supermarket and find one. And so the industry has developed to, for better or for worse, it's kind of a Faustian bargain here. We get what we asked for. Compromises have to be made. Those things have to be shipped from Florida or Mexico in January and on a truck and get up to Madison. And the bottom line here, the real heart of the problem is the growers are not paid to produce a product that tastes good. The growers are paid on how many pounds of product they put into a box, and there's no feedback in terms of how much money does the grower get for producing something that tastes better. Well, they don't. They get nothing for producing something that tastes better. So they have focused solely on yield of each plant and how well that product ships, and they're picked when they're very green and shipped unripe, and you're paying the price. It's just not a very good tomato, but you know that's the economic system that's been set up and is in place today.
And our last caller, I should mention, and I'm suddenly blanked, but if she wants the original Rutgers tomato seeds, the Seed Savers Exchange, now it came to me, in Decorah, Iowa, is one place where you can get the seeds and grow your own Rutgers. Maybe she can grow some Rutgers tomatoes for her mom.
Yeah, there are a number of seed sources for a lot of these heirloom tomatoes, and Rutgers is one of them. You can certainly get Rutgers seed.
We're talking today with our guest, Dr. Tomato, Harry Klee, Professor of Horticultural Sciences in Plant Molecular and Cellular Biology, that program at the University of Florida, talking with him about his research on producing a better tasting tomato. Tell you, the all you gave a little history here about why we're doing what we're doing. I'd like you to talk a little about your research, because it's interesting to me. Because you, in the research, I expect you want better taste, but you also almost also need to think about those other things like packaging and moving and shipping and so forth.
Yeah, so I mean, I kind of see our research in two phases. First of all, we need to understand what is good flavor. What is the chemistry underlying good flavor? And, you know, this goes to way beyond tomato, but tomato is a great system to understand what is it that when we take it in registers as being good. So we've actually exploited the heirloom tomatoes extensively. We've grown hundreds of varieties of them, I think. And what we do is, in principle, very simple. We grow them up. We give them to a large consumer panel, and those people rate the quality of that tomato. And then we grind them up and figure out what's in them. In terms of chemical constituents. And so when we do enough of those, we can just use really simple statistical programs to say what's in the good tomato, what's in the bad tomato, and how much of it. So in that regard, basically by screening many of these heirlooms, and I'll tell you, some of these, you know, people have this idea, oh, heirloom tomato is great. A lot of these heirlooms are terrible. They're just, they just don't taste good, and you eat them, and you say, what were they thinking when they saved this one? But some of them are absolutely fabulous. So for us, it's been just a bonanza, you know, the variation that's out there in these different heirlooms. And so it's allowed us to basically create a recipe for what is a great tasting tomato. What is the chemistry that underlies something that everybody would agree is a really good tomato? So then once we have that knowledge, the trick is how do you apply it?
And right.
So I think what we see is two phases. What we've focused on first is, can we get some of these heirloom varieties, can we make a modern heirloom that is something that grows really well but has all the taste of the heirlooms? And so we can do that, and we've actually had some success doing that. We've taken all of our knowledge of what are the best tasting heirlooms, and then we simply make a hybrid between it and a modern variety that has good disease resistance, good productivity. The fruit aren't quite so soft that they fall apart a day after you pick them. And we've actually made a number of varieties that taste really good and produce, you know, twice the yield of the heirlooms and taste just as good.
Harry Klee, our guest today, professor of horticulture at the University of Florida. I'm having a great time talking with him about his research on good-tasting tomatoes. We'll be back with him after the news. Well, there's nothing like a delicious, juicy, sweet, tart tomato, whether it's a part of a great BLT or maybe the base of a wonderful homemade tomato sauce, or enjoy just a little salt and pepper on top. Nothing better. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Good to have you along today on the Ideas Network. More and more, unless you grow them yourself or can get to a local farmer's market, a good-tasting tomato is just a distant memory. Hopefully not for long. Harry Klee, professor of horticultural sciences in the Plant Molecular and Cellular Biology program at the University of Florida, our guest today. His research focuses on how to return tomatoes to their former glory, and he joins us from his office in Gainesville, Florida. And once again, Harry, thank you for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And we have some callers online. You may have a question. Do you have some memories of when tomatoes at the store tasted good? How long has that been? Do you have a favorite heirloom tomato? Which one and why? Or maybe you have a question about tomatoes. Harry's known as Dr. Tomato, and he can certainly answer your question, I believe, if you call in or shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. Randy in Kewaskum, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I know you're already seeing some places that are adjusting to the people are kind of demanding more of the heirlooms again. I know even Stein Gardens has a number of heirloom tomatoes that they sell. You know, I've been growing them from seed. My time is kind of at a premium, but I think I picked up like Rutgers and Cherokee and one was a German variety, and there were like four or five different heirloom tomatoes for sale at Stein's even. So
they're out there. You're breaking up a little bit, Randy, on it. So, yeah, I think it's not just places like perhaps the going to Decorah, Iowa, but some of the horticultural businesses that service local consumers have certainly gotten on the bandwagon with heirloom tomatoes. Harry.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think it's what's really exciting is that there's been a movement in the last 10 years or so driven by things like the Food Network and all of the PBS food shows. I think there's a real much more interest in them. You can get a lot of stuff. You can get anything in seeds. Getting them in plants is a little harder still. You're lucky if you've got a place that you can go to get real heirloom tomatoes. But the big problem, I think, is that those heirlooms, yeah, they taste great, but some of them are really hard to grow.
Yeah.
And so that's why we're really focusing on can we make them hardier plants without compromising the flavor? That's been a major effort on our part.
Luba in Madison will turn to you next. Hi, Luba.
Hi. Well, thank you for accepting my call. Now, I have one question regarding tomatoes and then an experience that I had with taste. And my question is, what is a good tomato for tomato juice? And my experience regards ice cream. And I noticed that when I ate an ice cream cone, I used my tongue to lick the ice cream, and I got a different sensation. And when I ate ice cream with a spoon, it was something utterly different.
All right. You were breaking up again, Lou. I don't know why we're having a little phone trouble here, but Harry, did you get that?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the flavor is interesting. I think that the spoon, first of all, you're putting the food further back in your mouth, and you're getting the distribution of the taste receptors on your tongue is very different from front to back. So you actually are getting a different experience if you put the same food on the very front of your tongue versus the back of your tongue, and that's going to affect also how much gets up to your what's called the olfactory system, which it's smell, but there are two ways that you get smell. One is through the back of your mouth, and the other is through your nose. And so the position in the mouth can be really important. But I think the big thing she's talking about here is just the difference of where the taste receptors are on the cell, on the tongue, rather.
Yep.
Really change the way things taste. With regards to tomato juice, I have to say, we have tried so hard to do like a tomato puree, to get people on our panels to taste so that we could go in and change the composition by adding in, various volatile chemicals or sugars or acids. And almost everybody that we work with just thinks that a ground up tomato taste is vile. they just really don't like it. You know, the tomato juices that you buy in the store are pretty good, but in large part it's because they add a ton of salt to them.
Yeah.
We just do not like a ground up tomato, period.
That's funny, isn't it? Oh, Gail in Whitehall, let's turn to you next. Hi, Gail.
Good afternoon. I got a question. Now, I presume you're down in zone 9, between 9 and 10, correct?
Yeah, somewhere in that range, northern Florida. So we're not tropical, yeah.
No. Well, I have a home. I spend the winter down in South Texas.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know of any good tomatoes, any good-tasting tomatoes down there. I tried planting four different varieties of rather large plants in March.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, by the time my son got down there due to the drought, they were all pretty well dead.
Yeah.
I don't know of any. In fact, the guy I bought them from at the nursery said that they won't, tomatoes don't do well after the 1st of June.
Yeah, their climate, your climate there is going to be very similar to ours. So we actually plant our tomatoes around the first week in March if we can. We sometimes get, this year we got a freeze on March 15th, but we try and plant in March. And we're actually at the height of our harvest right now. Literally just 2 days ago was probably the peak of our harvest. It gets too hot, and this is something people up north just don't comprehend. We can't grow tomatoes down the south in the summertime because it's too hot and they don't set good fruit. I have on our website, if you just Google me, you can find the website. We actually have a list of our heirlooms that we've tried and the consumer panel ratings, which are like the averages of 100 people. And for you, that probably is really useful, good information on what grows well. For the people up north that are mostly listening to the show, I would say you have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. Florida is a really hard place to grow tomatoes. The soil is awful. It's hot. We have lots of diseases. I'd like to think that if they do well here, they'll do well anywhere, but we can't promise that the ones that do well down here will flourish up in Wisconsin.
Yeah. What's your setup like there? I mean, how many acres of tomatoes do you have, and what do you do to amend your soils and so forth?
Unfortunately, and this is part of the problem with growing tomatoes in Florida, our tomatoes pretty lousy. Our soil is pretty lousy. It's mostly sand. So typically, what we do is we put plastic beds on around our plants, and we use like drip tape for irrigation because you don't want to really water them overhead. That only encourages diseases.
Yeah.
And so we grow them up on top of plastic, and we stake them up to keep them up off the ground. So they're watered probably a couple of times a day here because there's no organic matter to speak of in the soil. So what we get, the only thing they're getting is the fertilizer that we put into the water. And again, it's just not a great place. It's almost like growing hydroponic tomatoes here.
Boy. Mike in Spring Green has a question for you. Hi, Mike.
Hello there. Question is regarding shelf life or keeping quality.
Mm-hmm.
There are at least a couple of heirlooms, heirloom tomatoes that have extremely long shelf life. And this past winter, I had one of them on the shelf until April 1st, and it was still fine.
Wow.
Sitting on the counter. One of them is Garden Peach, a fuzzy yellow one,
uh-huh.
And the other is Wapsipinicon, not fuzzy, almost the same size and a little oranger.
Yeah. Yeah, we've grown that one. So, yeah, that's amazing.
Where did they get that?
Well, to be honest, at a scientific level, we really don't understand all of the ways that the tissues break down. We know some of the enzymes, but and early on in biotechnology programs, actually the very first biotech product was a tomato that was developed by a company called Calgene, and it knocked out one of the enzymes that's responsible for fruit softening. It wasn't a great tomato, but it was an okay tomato. But it wasn't the whole picture. It's really complicated how these tissues break down over time. But I think those guys. I've never tried to save one nearly that long. I've seen people who say that they do that.
Yeah.
The plant is the fruit is a living organism, and it's going to continue to use up sugars and acids. And I've never done the experiment myself, but I'm not sure I want to eat one that was grown in Wisconsin and saved until April.
When we talk about, you're talking about managing or engineering fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. I know some people are concerned, you know, are we talking about Frankenfoods here? Mm-hmm. You're actually trying to bring tomatoes back to their original state in many ways, aren't you?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, we're not trying to make something that wasn't there to begin with. What we're trying to understand is what were the varieties. So some of the varieties we work with, for example, one that people up there might know is called Wisconsin 55.
Oh, yeah.
it's a very old variety. It actually has pretty good taste. But we go back, some of the ones, the original tomato breeder that we can document is a guy named Livingston, who was in Ohio in the late 1800s. And we actually are going back to some of his varieties. Stone is one, and that we've grown. We're trying to understand what was flavor, and we're trying to understand how the modern breeders, basically since World War II, have lost the flavor. Yeah. And we're basically just trying to restore it to what it was. We're not trying to create any monsters, and we're also not using. We're just using traditional genetic methods to go back and recapture the genetics that was already there. We're not using biotechnology to do this. You know, we could, but we're not. We're really trying to just understand what went wrong.
Yeah. Harry, just a quick history lesson for us. Where did the tomato, or where were they first discovered, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So we don't really know all of the history of the tomato, but it was domesticated certainly either the northern part of South America or into Central America. We have some of the wild relatives that gave rise to the tomato, but basically the Aztecs in that area developed it and got it to the point where it tasted okay, but they were still pretty small. And then shortly after Columbus, you had the Spanish discovered the tomato in central Mexico and brought it back to Europe. And I would say that was sort of the start of the really serious intensive breeding of the tomato was done in the Mediterranean area back in the starting in the 1500s. But really, I would say modern breeding really started with this guy Livingston in Ohio. And he was the first person to really push new varieties of tomatoes that tasted good for the home grower, the farmer.
Well, we had an email from Marilyn in Beaver Dam wondering if there are any low-acid tomatoes that have really good flavor.
Oh, well, you know, that's an interesting cultural question. I would say the simple answer is probably yes, but I'd have trouble naming one right off the top of my head. Most people like a balance of sweet and sour, you know, a lot of the little tomatoes that you see in the store now, like the cherry tomatoes, they have incredibly high levels of sugar, but they don't have the acid to balance them, and they taste almost like candy. And a lot of people don't like that, but different cultures tend to like different things. So Hispanics tend to like a tomato that has more acidity than do, say, Northern European descendants. It's what we do with the tomato. It's what we grew up with and using it in our cuisine. There are tomatoes out there that have good acidity, and there are tomatoes that have low acidity. I would say that a lot of the small cherry, the cherry-type tomatoes, have very low acidity relative to the sweetness.
Listener Nick wonders if you have a recommendation for the best plum or Roma-style tomatoes. What's your...
We actually are we're developing one right now, actually, that we're planning to release. In fact, probably it'll get a name within the next couple of weeks, but it's not yet released. Now, I'm actually just going to my website as we talk.
That's fine.
And going down and looking at them. You know, for processing tomatoes, we don't focus a lot on them because they're almost like a different beast. They really are very different. You know, the traditional, just what's called Roma, is not a bad tomato for making paste. But some of the smaller old ones have a lot of flavor and not as much water. I would stick with just the traditional Roma myself.
Oh. Jill in Rhinelander, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to relate a story. Heard it on public radio. A gentleman called, and he said he was following behind one of those big open-top semis. And there were these green things that were bouncing out and hitting the pavement and rolling, and he thought, Granny Smith apples? So he pulled over and he picked one up, and it was a tomato.
Yep.
So that actually is a guy named Barry Estabrook who wrote a book called Tomato Land, and he starts his book actually with the anecdote of driving down Interstate 75 and seeing one of these things bounce and hit his windshield. and it retained its round shape and nearly broke his windshield. And he's correct. The stuff that's picked that you see in your supermarkets that's just sort of the unlabeled bulk tomatoes are generally picked when they're right, when they're fully green, and they're hard as a rock.
Bill in Fort Atkinson, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am originally from Indiana, and I've never tasted a tomato that tasted as good as Indiana tomatoes.
Why would that be, Harry?
Oh, gee, everybody has those stories. We've already heard the New Jersey story. It is true Indiana and Ohio used to be hotbeds of growing tomatoes. You know, Heinz and had big operations there. Most of it went into things like ketchup and tomato sauce. But, you know, you can grow a pretty good tomato. You know, when I started working on tomatoes, we were growing them in Illinois, and the soil was just so incredibly rich. I mean, they tasted really good. The fact is, the Midwest has some pretty good soil.
We had an email from Jim in Mequon about 10 years ago, after at least a year going by since I had a good-tasting tomato. We made our yearly trip to Jamaica, and they had a bumper crop of absolutely delicious tomatoes. I ignored my usual favorite tropical fruits and spent the week eating tomatoes.
Wow.
When they ran out, I ate the decorative tomato roses.
We have never grown one in Jamaica. I'd be curious what variety. I'll tell you, you know, when I do these kinds of interviews, I usually, almost always, someone will contact me and say that they've got a really good variety that they've been growing for years, and they send me seeds, and we do grow them out. We have a guy from Alabama who just sent us probably 20 different varieties that he says he's really loves, and we've got them in the field this summer. And some of them are really good. We're always looking for something that tastes really good.
And a Facebook question from Whitney. Why is it that grape tomatoes taste pretty good all year? Why haven't they had the same loss of flavor as regulars?
That's a really good question. First of all, they have not. It's a relatively recent introduction to the market. You haven't gotten grape tomatoes in the supermarkets for all that long, and the breeders really haven't focused as much attention on them as the big salad tomatoes. So they haven't had as much time to mess them up. But a simpler answer is the smaller fruits generally tend to be less demanding, and they, to digress into a little plant physiology, basically the leaves are taking carbon dioxide out of the air and they're turning it into sugar. And when you've got a plant that's got a whole bunch of little fruit on it, it's not quite as demanding as one that's got these massive-sized large fruits that it's pumping out, and it has more ability to fill them up with sugar. Ugh. And so you end up, the smaller fruits have more sugar. And most people, believe it or not, like sweet. And the more sugar, the more people like them. And the small tomatoes, the grapes and the cherries, have more sugar. They for a per-pound basis, they have way more sugar than those big tomatoes. And so people like them more.
Harry, thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. We're going to direct people to your website because we want to see those ratings of the tomatoes that you've grown. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. Harry Klee, we'll have his, actually, if you write Harry Klee, K-L-E-E, into your search engine, I'm sure it's going to, his site is going to pop up. But we'll have it also posted on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Interesting topic, isn't it? Tomorrow we'll find out what aquatic invasive plants are a problem out here in Wisconsin and how we can help prevent their spread. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.